Good afternoon, and welcome to Who's in the Kitchen. You're listening to WDRT 91.9 FM and streaming live on the internet at WDRT.org, where you can go and listen to archived shows, including this one. And my guests today are Dave Tubin of Second Nature Nursery between Viroqua and Reedstown. And Joseph Meyer, who is my old friend who cooks and demonstrates cooking and teaches, and he has Latarnia Guest House down by Seneca. So we're going to talk about edible gardens, and I suppose you mean the kind of things that are edible that you don't usually put in your vegetable garden, because all vegetable gardens are edible, right? But we're thinking about other kinds of edibles.
Edible landscaping.
And so that's going to be our theme today. So thanks so much for joining us, and welcome, you guys.
Well, nice, thank you.
Nice to see you.
Yeah, thank you.
We've got a nice pairing of these two fellows because Joseph often gives demonstrations at your events during the summer.
Our third Thursday events.
Third Thursday. So you can tell us more about that. But Joseph likes to share his cooking skills and for free and for hire. And, you know, you can really learn a lot from Joseph. And he has been really a very helpful person in my show because he steers me toward new people in the area that
there's
he feels.
So many interesting people in this area.
Yes, about food and who's in the kitchen. So he's kind of my program guide and a little bit, my producer. So, yeah, Dave, tell us a little bit about Second Nature. And you have taken you've taken that nursery, which has quite a long history.
It has a very, very long history, dating back about 60 years, where Royce Jones started that nursery. And I think a lot of people in the community know Royce. They love him.
Yes.
We never had the pleasure to meet Royce ever. I wish we had. We have befriended the family. They allowed us to copy his memoirs that he wrote.
Oh.
And it's a, what a life, you know. I guess everybody has an amazing life, you know, and I guess if you have the opportunity to sit down and write your life for other people to read, his was just very, very interesting.
Right.
Later in life, he found a real passion for landscape, trees, anything that grew, anything that he could eat. I guess if we're talking about edible landscapes, he kind of was in that movement. I think when Driftless was starting and everything was kind of coming on and everything was sort of all natural, I think he was already there.
He was. I mean, I live practically across the road from him.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
And I watched that nursery go through its different stages. But one of the things Royce was really devoted to is carrying plants that actually live in this area, because you go to the grocery store, you know, at springtime and pick up an apple tree or peach tree that was never going to survive the winter.
Yeah.
And he was into native plants and that sort of thing, and things that, grapes and things that really would survive in our zone 4.
Yeah, so that entire property down there is 240 acres.
Oh,
and so
okay.
The original nursery, as you know, was on the south end of the property, where the barn still stands and the house still stands.
Right.
And there's some amazing plants down there because he was grafting things. He was putting cork trees with tulip trees and getting some trees that you look at them, you're like, I don't know what that is. I don't know why it is, you know, but it's there. And it's really exciting.
Oh, yeah. Amazing.
And then the nursery took many progressions. Then it was owned by Bill Kapler. He had it for about 20 years, and then we purchased it 10 years ago from Jack and Bill Kapler.
And you immediately had a huge flood.
We did.
That washed most of your potted plants down.
Yeah, well, it threw out all our bad ideas, and I like to say that it reset us to understand that we were supposed to be doing more what Mother Nature wanted us to do, not maybe what we thought we should be doing. It was a giant reset.
But a lot of the community came in and really helped you, didn't they?
It was
Oh, we had to pull things out of...
I think outside of getting married and the birth of my children, I think maybe it was the most humbling experience I ever had. The water, you know, was... Jen, my wife, we drove down there that morning, and we kind of looked around, and it was dark, you know, because we had terrible storms. We had 13 inches of rain. We got to the nursery. It was still dark, and we're like, oh, it's not that bad. And then the sun started to break over the hills. We're like, oh, that's bad. You know, that was terrible.
That's Reed's Creek, which looks so mild-mannered and barely, you know, and it just amazing how much damage that can do if it's... leaps its banks.
Yeah, it was devastating. And then we were just sort of standing there, and I think both of us were kind of like, well, you know, the whole nursery thing, that was cute. We tried it, you know. And then our employees started showing up, and then the community started showing up, and the Boy Scouts showed up, and then the Waldorf kids showed up, and everyone just started picking up pots.
Yeah, you really had a lot of community loyalty to that place.
Yeah, and, it was an amazing experience.
Yeah, well, thank you for sharing that. And I'm sure our listeners, many of my listeners, you know that nursery and are probably really interested in the history. And Joseph, you came out here. When did you come out? About 10 years ago?
My beautiful Patty and I moved out here 4.5 years ago.
It's only been four and a half years.
We moved out here from the Chicago area.
With an intention of having a bed and breakfast?
No.
No.
We were retiring from high-stress jobs post-COVID. We needed to get out and away from... We ran away from all of our stress. This was an area that I had been fly fishing in for 20 years. Mm-hmm. I had a fly shop in Chicago, so I was doing my on-the-water trout schools up here. I was doing cooking classes at the Mayfly Lodge in Newton. That's one of those towns in Wisconsin where there is no town. Newton, it's right up the road from Purdy, where there's no town there either. So I knew this area a lot.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And when we moved into a beautiful home, the builder... His attitude is, I build them, I don't decorate, I don't landscape, I do what I do. And we wandered into Second Nature looking for help. We needed help first before we needed plants. And we met lovely woman named Alicia, who is the landscape designer there. She's an amazing listener when... We wanted to do a bed in the front of the house, and I said, I don't want anything. She recommended a couple of things, and I said, I don't want anything too farmy. And she said, tell me what that means. And I'm like, daylilies, hollyhocks, spirea, and she's making notes. And she said, okay, now that I know what you don't want, let me steer you to what may work for you. And designed it so that this is what you can do right now. You can go out, buy the plants, go home, put them in the ground right now. This is what you can do in the fall. This is what you can do in the spring. You can build off of what we have planned here. And that's how we fell in love with Second Nature at Reed's Creek. Knowing its history and knowing it now is just amazing how Dave and Jen have moved it from a retail nursery to a community center.
It's a community center that's very valuable in this area.
To just chime in on that, we did the ultimate goal. We had another business. I think we were on the same trajectory as you guys. We were looking to slow life down. We had sold the business, and that didn't work. No, did it? However, we did want to create a space that would bring community together. And that was the whole plan behind Third Thursday as well, is it seems that when the rest of the world is divided, Third Thursday just brings people together. They share food, they share stories, their kids are all playing together on the little beach, you know, jumping off the rope swing, and
everything else kind of
falls away.
Food.
I think Vroke was a special little place, or this area is a special little place where people can have differences and they still love each other, you know. And things like after in Viroqua, the night markets, they weren't doing those anymore. I think Third Thursday is starting to fill that gap a little bit. And then it's amazing how when you start with one idea and you collaborate with other people like Joseph, and Joseph's like, hey, we should try this. And it was his culinary adventures. We call it Under the Arbor. And it's, gosh, Joseph, when it started, maybe there was 10 or 12 people that joined us. And now we're considering having to move it because
standing room only. Yeah,
and it's so fun.
They have, Jen and Dave have positioned this as Under the Arbor. And when the first time I walked out to Dave's like, okay, this is where you're going to teach. And it's the most beautiful outdoor classroom in the entire world. And let me back up to how we met and how we started working together. We met through Second Nature. Patty and I had them out for dinner. I will cook for Dave at any time because he is a good eater. He bows his head to say grace and doesn't pick his head up until the plate is clean.
Yeah.
there are times that there are sparks coming from the fork, so it feeds my ego when
you shouldn't feed people on a metal plate.
When I feed Dave. And then he and his family, extended family, came out for a cooking class. And Dave's like, you're really good at this. You should be doing this like for other people. And we kicked around the idea of doing an Under the Arbor thing. And he said, do you want me to plant something for you to use? Do you want to take people on a walk through the nursery? What do you want to do? And I said, well, I think I want to do, we teach building skills. So we're going to teach how to make mayonnaise, and then we're going to teach how to make pesto. So if you could grow some basil for me, he's like, basil's easy. I'll have some grown for you. So it comes the day of the first third Thursday market, and I'm getting set up on a folding table and under the arbor, and it's beautiful. And then Dave comes over with a little tractor pulling a cart that's got to be 6 feet by 8 feet filled with growing basil. Six feet by 8 feet. There were five different kinds of basil in there. And there was lemon basil and chocolate basil and all the Genovese basil and Thai basil. And I just wanted to roll in that stuff. And as I'm teaching, I'm literally turning to this huge thing of basil to rinse it off and make pesto. So we've had a lot of fun.
Yeah,
that is wonderful collaboration.
Working with new and local and what's fresh. From a culinary standpoint, the challenge is I'm working off of an 8-foot table with one extension cord.
What about electricity and water?
I have electricity and water.
We have a hose.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
We have to stop watering the arborvita because Joseph needs to fill a pot.
Right.
So I'm not working anything with an oven or a broiler. We've brought in a grill. But when we first started, there are all these seats and it's kind of lovely, and I see a half a dozen people, and I am competing with the musicians who were up on the deck.
Yeah.
And it's not that far away, but when you've got big, loud acts like Ann Christopher, I'm having to compete with them. When they've got the Lovelies, who are a softer, more harmonious, that's
more
not
background.
That's not so bad.
Yeah.
I've worked there when the Guthries were there, and
they can get pretty lively.
They can. Erica Guthrie is just a delight when she, on the stage, she's saying, okay, Joseph is under the arbor. Everybody go over there. And she said, so I lose all my crowd. And they're over watching Joseph cook.
Mm-hmm.
And she's up there playing and singing with Scott. And I'm cooking thinking, I really want to go hear Scott and Erica. We'll just kind of trade crowds.
Too much good stuff going on
so
at the
we'll,
same time.
So we'll be going, and we provide some educational component and some entertainment component under the arbor and have a good time. And then I look up and there's 45, 50 people that are there. So they're all just taking it all in. We sample some. I mean, I'm not cooking dinner for everybody, but people want to know, what does that taste like?
Well,
that look
yeah.
really cool.
Yeah.
I would argue that you don't sample some. I would argue that some people don't go away hungry. it's amazing because what you've done is collaborate with these amazing other people in our community that I think people just don't realize what's out here.
Yep, that was the second or third year Dave and Jen came to me and said, how do you feel about collaborations with other people?
Oh, gosh.
I'm like, absolutely. There's so many people that I want to work with and had worked with in the past and would want to do it again. And as it turns out, and Patty pointed out to me this morning, that all your collaborations have been with women at Second Nature. So we've worked with Deanna Pedretti from Vernon Vineyards.
Well, I was going to mention Vernon Vineyards because I know those people have really grown close to you, and you always like to bring their wines into the culinary.
It's what we serve at Latarnia. So, Deanna Pedretti, Sarah Clemens from Noble Rind, and she's just a wealth of information. Every time I'm in her presence, I learn something more.
So a lot about. Mainly cheese and charcuterie.
Yep. Right? Yep. She and her family took a pasta class from us, and I needed to kind of shift gears when we were done with one task and go on to another task. And I had a block of pecorino and a block of Parmigiano Reggiano, and I said to Sarah, "Just kill 20 seconds while I change pots on the stove." And she launched into this lovely dissertation about this is sheep's milk, this is cow's milk, this is saltier, this is nuttier. And I'm in my own kitchen pulling up a chair listening to Sarah. Like, oh, I got to get busy cooking. So Sarah was lovely to work with. Rachel Parker from Parker Family Farms and her husband Mark.
Yes, I've discovered her too.
Just lovely.
So she has some of the meat?
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed. And they have a breakfast sausage that they showed, and they put a special grind on there that made me change my way of thinking about breakfast sausage. It's ground much finer and really lovely. So this year, the collaborations that we've planned, working with the absolutely amazing Amy Forgs from Hidden Springs Creamery. I know you've had Amy on your show, and she's just brilliant and wonderful.
That's the first third Thursday.
That'll be the first one.
May 21st.
Okay, May 21st.
Yep. And then in June, we're collaborating with Regan Davey from Milk and Honey, the new coffee shop in Westby. And she's absolutely a delight. I'm 27 years in recovery. Took a look at the mocktails that she's offering out, and
so it's just not just coffee.
Correct.
Oh,
yeah, that'll be a lot of fun.
And you've suggested that she be on the show, so I'm gonna
absolutely
have to check that out.
Absolutely.
Yeah, how wonderful.
She's made a beautiful coffee shop out of this little basement area below New Horizons real estate office, and it's really cute. And then she's got her little picnic tables up on the deck. That's June. July, we're working with Sarah Clemens again from Noble Rind. She'll probably pull out something new and different.
Well, they're there too at Third Thursday, offering, because we have food vendors there with their food, and they sell out every time.
Sure.
So the Third Thursdays continue to get busier and busier and busier.
No,
I would say we're now somewhere between 200 and 400 people that show up.
Kind of weather dependent, but
and it's great that you just have so much parking available. It's a great venue for this, because when you start getting, you know, hundreds of people, that's a challenge to have something at your. So please give us the dates: May 21st and June.
Yeah, May 21st, June 18th. Mm-hmm. It's always the third Thursday of every month. July 16th.
Mm-hmm.
August 20th. And September 17th. So it's 5 Third Thursdays.
And I mean, just almost every interest you can imagine, it would be fulfilled there. But if you want cooking classes, just to go to these cooking classes would just be...
It's an awful lot of fun.
But always music and food vendors and plants.
And don't forget, we sell plants. But I think one of my very favorite is the kid vendors, all the children that show up, and they're selling... Lego people, and they're trading Pokemon cards and baseball cards and
little handmade bracelets.
It's
crocheted
the lemonade stand of Vernon County. It's just the cutest, most homespun, and people can wander around. There's food there for families to feed their kids who are running around, being on the beach, because it's right there at Reed's Creek. Great little sandbox. One of our mutual friends was chatting with a little boy who mentioned that the toys there had seen better days, and they really could use a better dump truck for the kids to play with. And
I think I have some of those.
A couple of days later, she...
Yeah. The community showed up. People just, after that video kind of went viral, people just started bringing, like, dump trucks, diggers, tractors. So now we have, you know, because you're running a business. You don't always think, gosh, then you make a sandbox and you're like, gosh, we didn't take the time to really clue in to make sure we had the toys for the kids that they would enjoy. But now, yeah, absolutely. Parents literally have a hard time pulling their children away from the sandbox.
What a wonderful place. What a wonderful venue where kids want to go and want to participate. They have ideas of how to make it even more interesting there. How just it sounds great.
The August date and the September date, it'll be Patty and I doing the demonstrations there, which are an awful lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
We have a sous chef, Deb Murison, who is a delight to work with.
Who is that?
Deb Murison. She was with us on a show when we were talking about stoves and
oh, yes, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I tend to forget to introduce her, even though she's standing right next to me. But she's an awful lot of fun and an extra pair of hands. We were demonstrating a cantaloupe salad with Driftless Provisions salami.
I think my mouth just watered.
And I was dicing up the cantaloupe outside on my 8-foot table with no electricity and limited water. And Deb kind of leans in and whispers, those chunks are not evenly cut. That's a pretty rough cut. That's not really even. And I whispered back at her, we can always give them their money back. And she starts laughing. But she's a delight to have, extra pair of hands. And I can continue to demo while she's putting food out or samples out. So it's very cool.
Well, thank you, and I'm just going to take a station break and let you know you're listening to WDRT 91.9 FM Community Radio from the ground up here in the Driftless area. We're recording here at in Viroqua, and I'm talking with Joseph Meyer and Dave Tubin. Joseph is from Laternia Guest House down by Seneca, and Dave Tubin is running this fabulous Second Nature Nursery, which is turning out to be really a community center. And we've been focusing on the Third Thursday program during the summer, which starts May 21st and goes through September 17th, the third Thursday of every month. Food, music, food demonstration, great big sandbox for the kids, and sales of crafts. It's a wonderful community, all ages welcome. And so we're going to, our topic today, though, is landscape, the edible landscape. So we've got two really great people here, and Dave has done so much. Well, just we were talking about cooking with the basil that he grew there, and he had, you know, like 8 varieties of basil. So it is fun. I mean, I think, oh, sure, yeah, we all have, you know, a little vegetable garden, maybe not all of us, but but then you think about other things that you could put in your landscape that would be kind of dual purpose.
Absolutely.
Our next door neighbor has a high chain link fence around his garden to keep the deer out.
Uh-huh.
And on the outside of the fence, one year he had a couple of clumps of chives growing. And ever since then, every year he divides each clump, and he has made
a border,
a hedge of chives that softens, aesthetically, it softens up that chain link fence. He feels as though it deters deer.
Oh, I'd like to know about that.
But he's made a little border out of chives.
Just free chives, because, man, you can divide them up pretty fast. And yes,
you should put that stuff in everything.
Oh, I think so. There's nature's little onions, you know, first things in the spring when nothing else is coming up. Your good old chives.
Yeah.
And the garlic. I always love to have my garlic coming up early, because you plant that in the fall, and then it's poking up long before anything else looks alive. But yeah, I'd love to know more about things to keep the pests off.
Dave and Jen had a man who did an edible landscaping conversation that was there, and he showed pictures of lacinato kale and Swiss chard growing in and among perennials. But he said this kind of fills in the spaces. It's happy. they don't need a lot of care and a lot of hands-on and fertilizing and weeding, and having all that kale helps keep down the weeds. And Patty and I are looking at each other like, we should be doing...
It's a very pretty kale. It's very elegant looking, and it sticks around after everything else died.
and rainbow chard is just as pretty.
Yeah, good idea.
We have an 8-foot-tall retaining wall made out of limestone blocks, and we our fire pit, and we entertain at the base of this. And so we have all this raw rock that's there, and we started planting at the top. We started planting nasturtiums that would cascade down, and as long as they have a place to grow, they will continue to fill that space. And landscaping that area with nasturtiums was stunning.
Gosh, I can't hardly get nasturtiums to grow. Maybe they like that limestone.
Interesting.
I'm wondering if I'm just putting them in the wrong place, or
they typically will grow almost anywhere unless it's really, really wet. You know, so you do need kind of a more well-drained soil. It's kind of like when you get to lavender, because you can put lavender in a lot of things. It's just a great accent to a lot of food. But lavender likes it rough. It's a rough plant. People are always trying to baby it. I said, you should really put sand in the hole. Stop watering it, for God's sake.
Don't treat it like your other plants. Lavender and the rosemary. Absolutely. They just, when you see them growing naturally, they're practically in deserts.
They're a desert plant. So people just, I'm like, stop watering it. You know, you tell everybody, water, 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 water. And you're like, lavender, you're like, stop watering it. Stop watering it. You know, put rocks in there.
Rosemary's the same way. It's the essential, it's the oils that are in the rosemary that's what we're looking for.
Will they deter pests? I mean, like deer? Do you think rosemary and...
I don't think so. No. I think it's too low to the ground to really deter the deer. But
you know what one gardener told me, a market gardener, he said that he strings fishing line. So he doesn't have to put up a big fence. But the gardeners need to know the fishing line is there. But he said they hate running into this line, and they just stay away. So it might be something that a person could do in a garden, like in your front yard where you don't want an anchor fence.
You mean
or
like
some...
100-pound test line or something?
Well, I guess it just doesn't, it feels icky, and they don't like to do it. And another thing he told me, what keeps the raccoons away, is squash plants, because they don't like to step on the kind of fuzzy stems.
They're
and
not
leaves.
Quite prickly, but they do have some rigidity to the
and
little spines.
And he would plant those around the border of his garden. But I would welcome other suggestions you have, because that's a problem.
And squash plants and pumpkin plants, their vines also cascade, and you can stretch them out over some bare spot. We had delicata squash and some carnival squash plants, and those cascaded down over the brick wall as well. And we were kind of learning, and I had people in garden centers kind of raise their eyebrow when I said, okay, which of these have the prettiest leaves?
Right.
It's like, well, the delicata is delicious. I'm like, oh, I know it is, and I can teach you 7 ways to make it. But compare its leaf with carnival squash or butternut squash or Hubbard squash, and he says, I've never had anybody ask me what are the leaves like. But they make a beautiful border plant.
I never thought about using squash in your, you know, decorative garden.
And they
cascading. It's just another way, because
of course
when they're when you think of gardening, we always think, I think, as a plane. We don't think vertically ever. And if you look at the commercial growers now, almost everything, is they're going vertical. Like if you go out by Tiffany and see her tomatoes, I mean, they're constantly tying up 12-foot-tall tomatoes on a commercial level. And so sometimes we can take some cues from that and say, if I have this retaining wall, maybe that's a good place to put my squash, because, A, it's not sitting necessarily in the dirt. It doesn't get that soft spot. It doesn't mold as fast. It doesn't break down as fast because it's not sitting in the dirt. So, again, thinking in your landscape vertically, and saying, where could I do some of this? Because it's actually, it grows fast. It's great cover, holds the weeds back.
Yeah.
You know, you're producing something that you'll have and enjoy in the fall, and, you know, fresh and canning or whatever you're doing with it.
But. We ate some of the squashes that we produced, but the rest of them wound up in our planters along the wall with little, you know, mini pumpkins. And we did grow mini pumpkins, and that that vine was huge. I now know that that's probably the biggest leaf, but it's monochromatic. I need to plant other stuff in there. Yeah. But your listeners should experiment with using squash as a border plant or a cascading plant, because it's an awful lot of fun.
Well, great. And now, some of these squashes, are they hybridized, or can you keep the seeds and resow them? Or is that one of those plants that you just don't dare? I mean, when you plant the seeds, you have no idea what will come in the next. I know some things are like that.
I think when you get into the heirloom varieties, those can be trusted to produce for you. You've got to pull them out and dry them and put them in a refrigerator. They got to go through their striation period, and then they're viable. But
you get so many seeds from the squash. Sure. It seems like, why not try? You know,
doubling back to nasturtiums. When you pull those up in the fall, you collect all of those little seeds. They look like big. Smaller than gooseberries, but they dry to look like a big peppercorn.
Yes.
And we replant those every year.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see in the fall when you go to pull them up, all these little chartreuse green peppercorns will drop down.
Can you pickle those? I thought they were kind of like capers.
I bet you could. Yeah. You would need an awful lot of them.
Well, yeah. Right. Right. Before they get dried out and hard, they're still green.
Sure.
I think I've heard that, but somebody might let me know whether I'm right or wrong.
We make nasturtium butter out of both the leaves and the blossoms from the nasturtium, because they're a nice peppery, bitey.
What? Tell us how to do that. Nasturtium butter?
So I'm harvesting all the leaves, and it's a big silver dollar, and you take your thumbnail and pinch off the stem. Get those all rinsed off. And you're harvesting the blossoms and get those all rinsed off. And they need to be dry so your butter doesn't absorb that water. And in a food processor, it's softened butter and the leaves, and you pulse that until the leaves break down to the consistency that you want. You don't want it to be a paste. So you'll have the big flecks of the green leaves that are in there. Then add a handful of nasturtium blossoms. And that'll provide the orange and yellow and cream in the. It's a very confetti-esque looking. Poured out onto some parchment paper, wax paper, plastic wrap, and roll it up like a sausage and put it in your fridge. And that goes on to a piece of grilled fish or a steak or vegetables that have been steamed. And you get that lovely pepperiness. If you're doing a lady's tea, nasturtium butter on white bread with slices of radishes and daikon. Now you're cooking.
Mm-hmm.
These are some of the things that we do at Second Nature when we show people. And I'm like, I have nasturtiums. I never thought. You know, people throw them into salad, and that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not into growing your own, I think Tiffany Cade at Deep Rooted Organics in Westby will offer the nasturtium blossoms in a package at the co-op, and those are beautiful in a salad or cocktails.
Well, the color is just lovely.
Exactly.
We're coming into a season two where the black locust or our native locust, those blooms are also very edible.
I did not know that. And so arugula, how can you
right
use
when
those?
they come out?
Okay.
Same thing. You could do a butter with them, but they're real nutty. They have a real nutty flavor to them. And when they start, you know, when you start to look in the hills and you see all this white kind of falling, you know, it's unmistakable, beautiful fragrance. They are edible when you first.
How does one harvest them? Are they up high? Like,
there's low ones.
There's
yeah.
low sure. trees. There's low, I mean, yeah, they start trees, out yeah. fairly low. Yeah. But you see them on the hillside. Sometimes I'm driving
Absolutely.
Back from Lafarge, and the hills are covered with these white
beautiful.
Blossoms.
I think when people are looking for morels, that would be the same time that you would be
interesting
looking for these
well,
blossoms.
You,
for
you ought to do the next third Thursday. Time. Now with Dave Tubin.
I am the kind of person that learns from
yep.
you. And I'm a yep. visual learner. You know, like I can listen to how you just talked about making nasturtium butter, but I would rather watch. And then go right into eating the nasturtium butter.
What kind of learner is that?
Yeah, exactly.
So let's talk about some other things that you can put in the garden that are edible.
Oh
I'm
gosh,
sure you got a lot. Big
there's
list.
So many. I think two of my favorite are aronia and blueberries. I think people think that just because they're berries, you can't use them, but both will give you beautiful flowering in the spring. You know. a dense foliage in the summer, and just the most fiery red colors in the fall. Beautiful reds and oranges in your landscape. Putting even three blueberries in the corner of a yard, they're great pollinators. They feed you. They look beautiful. They're amazing, easy to care for. Blueberries, of course, need a little higher acid soils and things like that. But the Aronia and Tony Mackesett, I don't know, do you know Tony Mackesett? Mm-hmm. So Tony's has some interesting things going on with Aronia right now that if you're really interested, go to the Main Street Marketplace, talk to Tony. But Aronia is, gosh, it's so good for you. It's the antioxidants. And
no, by itself, it's kind of a strong
very
berry,
tart.
Right?
Yeah.
Tart.
Yeah, there's no shame in adding sugar
right.
to things.
Right. but you need to know that when you use it in recipes. But,
yep.
I mean, you may want that tartness, you
right.
know, with your other ingredients.
Yep.
So, Aronias.
Those juices that I see on the shelf, have they been sweetened? I don't know a lot about Aronias.
I think
they
have.
Okay.
They have, and they have samples down there. I love it. I mean, it has an earthy taste to it.
Okay.
You know, I don't want to say dirt. It's just a natural taste, but then I'm more of a savory person. My palate loves anything more savory than sweet anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I really enjoy it. I love it.
Yeah, well, that kind of reminds me of elderberries, which are, you know, they're a little higher shrub, but people use the blossoms. I've made, dip it in a batter and fry it and make little elderflower, you know, fritters. But you can then, you know, a lot of people now are growing them or harvesting them wild. They just grow wild all over. And the elderberries are delicious.
I think being able to prepare, you know, to go out, grab an elderberry flower, bread it, and fry it and eat it.
Lord.
I just don't know if there's something more fun, like even for kids. Like
oh,
if we were looking,
we
like, how do we
kids.
Get these younger generations more involved?
Mm-hmm.
And that's just one. I think when you can take them through that whole process and it's relatively quick, you know, and then they get
pick
to
pick it and eat it.
pick it, fry it, eat it. That's pretty awesome.
Right.
When I lived in Chicago, neighbor came over, she was Asian, and my chives were blossoming. And she harvested all of the blossoms. And then what is she doing? And then an hour later she comes over and she had ever so carefully tempura battered just the blossom part, dipping it upside down.
Holding the stem, right.
Holy cow. She said, "I, you always let your blossoms just kind of die and wither. You should be eating them." I will from now on.
Yeah, that's amazing. Gosh.
Yeah.
And her tempura batter was like cornstarch and a thought of water. I mean, it was just the lightest. It was delightful.
Yeah, that's what makes tempura is the cornstarch, not flour, right?
Yep. Yep.
That sounds great.
And super light.
Well, we made some kind of liqueur out of elder blossoms and, I don't know, lemon or something with them. And a lot of sugar. It was a syrup. And then maybe you add liqueur or something like that if you want to. But
nice.
It's a very edible plant.
Sure.
I
worked with the chives that I had last year and learned to make a chive oil that doesn't turn brown.
Okay.
And I learned that there is an enzyme that attacks the chlorophyll, and that will turn it brown. So if you can get rid of that enzyme, your chive oil will stay green. Mm. So I'm harvesting the chives, and I'm blanching them 10 seconds in boiling water, shock them in ice water. That destroys the enzyme.
Oh.
So I still have all the chlorophyll. Then I, in a food processor with olive oil, I'm able to blend all that up and then strain it through a coffee filter, and I get that perfect green chive oil that stays in the jar.
And that's safe. To store. Okay.
It is.
But you don't really have the chives in there anymore. It's
You got
the color.
Just the,
and the flavor.
Chlorophyll color, and it's beautiful for drizzling on and any kind of steamed vegetables, grilled carrots. It's phenomenal. It's very cool.
Oh, wow. Of course, you can probably just use fresh chives and make butter like you did the butter.
I do.
Yeah.
Especially in the winter season, when I'm working with a recipe and it calls for a teaspoon of fresh dill, and I'm like, I have a handful of dill. I'm only using a teaspoon. What am I doing? I'm making dill butter. Mm-hmm. Out of it. Dill butter mm-hmm. is lovely. Sage butter is fabulous, although we tend to fry up the sage leaves and snack on those.
I love fried sage leaves. I learned that in Italy. Oh, my gosh. Do you dip those in cornstarch also?
Nothing. Dry.
You just fry them?
Yep. Absolutely dry. Oh. The way you might fry, if you're growing spinach and your spinach gets out of hand and it's great big, looks like a dinner mm-hmm. plate, as long as it's super dry, you can deep fry that, and it'll crisp up like a potato chip, and it's stunning.
Ooh, okay.
It's a stunning garnish on top of a steak or on top of a warm salad to have a fried spinach leaf. And fried sage leaves are excellent.
Oh,
that sounds like a whole nother class.
We'll fry up a bunch of sage.
We'll have to get us another extension cord.
Yeah. Fry up some sage leaves, and then we'll crush them in our fingers over popcorn, and
that sounds good.
There you go.
Yeah. Another beautiful ornamental is okra.
Yep.
That beautiful even if you plant, don't like okra, just grow over the flowers because it's really pretty, isn't it?
Yep. It's a great plant. And again, I think to Joseph's point earlier, to be able to fill some of those voids in the garden mm-hmm. with just a really cool plant. One other thing that we could talk about too is container gardening, because there's, I think, a lot of people that have limited space. They're living in apartments or just some people that need that start, that little push. And one thing that we love to do, and what we do at my house, is we have large containers, and we love to put evergreens in containers. And there's a handful of junipers that do extremely well
really
in containers. We have it at our place. We have a columnar green, which then we get all the juniper berry.
And I don't know how to use juniper berry.
Well, then you probably don't drink a lot of gin.
Yeah. You can just get gin straight out of the berries. I think it's a little process, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Juniper berries are fabulous in cooked sauerkraut.
Mm.
Juniper berries, mm-hmm. Four or five with a pork roast, is really pretty good. The juniper berries will flavor the rendered fat from the pork roast, and if you keep basting that, it has a nice earthy flavor and not a pine tree flavor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Too much of mm-hmm. juniper berries is too much is too much. It's like rosemary. A little bit goes a long way.
Right. With those herbs, you really want to not overdo them, or then people don't like them and they don't want to. Yeah. What other grows?
Well, in that container, so you can put a container. And I love to do coleus. I know you. I don't think you can eat it. You probably. I don't know.
I don't know if you can eat coleus or not. Maybe not, but I don't know.
But it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. And you can mix those coleus. And I think one thing that people don't know is if you have two different types of coleus together in proximity, bees will pollinate those coleus. And if you keep those seeds the next year, you will have a whole new variety of coleus because it will show traits from both of those plants. So it's really, really interesting to do. And at the base of it, we love to do some type of like apple mint. Mint should always be planted in a container, never in the garden because it takes over.
It needs to be contained.
But mint is such a robust, fun plant. And mm-hmm. we put mint in a lot of things. You can make jellies. We put it in lemonade. I love mint on everything, but
mm-hmm. how are strawberries in containers? Does that work?
They're okay. They've come up with some new varieties that they say are ever bearing. I just haven't found one that does really, really great in a container.
Mm-hmm. We have special jars, and you think, won't that be pretty? But
we're creatures of habit. We love to gravitate towards everything that's mm-hmm. brand new. Not realizing that it's brand new because they're marketing to us because they have to have something new to sell.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Patents run out, so they're always kind of developing mm-hmm. these new things. But sometimes we do step away mm-hmm. from some of the things, and this was in Royce Jones' memoirs, we do step away from some of the things that we know work and that are beautiful. And sometimes we're starting to see it now where people are like, I heard about this Annabelle hydrangea, and we're like, I heard about it. My God, it's been around for 60 years or however long it's been around. But, sometimes we're this time of year in spring, I can't even tell you how many calls we get a day, and people are online and with ChatGPT and AI, and they're like, I have this design that I got through AI, and and whatnot, and every single plant is out of our zone, you know, because they forgot to put, you know, zone 4, 5A. Which we're 5A now, and I would say we're a solid 5A in certain spots. If you're high up on a, if you're up high and you've got those harsh north winds, then no, I would say we're still a solid 4. But if you're in towns and you have protected areas, or you're on wood lines, or there's certainly 5A areas. But
yeah, people kind of wanna.
You were speaking about old things coming around new again. Again, Patty and I came from the Chicago market, where it was the largest crop produced in the United States is lawn. And we had lawns in Chicago. And I have a hillside that's too steep to mow. And we were of the opinion that as long as it's the needle is somewhere between a pasture and a suburban lawn, we were okay. But we lost the person who was mowing it. And Dave said, have you thought about converting your entire hillside to Dutch white clover? And I'm like, that's the stuff that I tried to kill on my lawn in Chicago. And he's like, don't do that. Don't do that. This is this is a bee-friendly no-mow. And I'm like, tell me more about no-mow. So my super steep hillside, and I had a couple of lawn mowing services come out to quote on mowing it, and they both went, no. No, this is too dangerous for our equipment to get to mow. Dave and his crew came out, killed off my hillside, scarified all of the soil, hand broadcast white Dutch white clover seeds, put down anti-erosion mats. 6 weeks later, I have a beautiful 3/4 of an acre of clover that I don't have to mow.
How high does it grow? Like
six to eight inches.
Yeah. I bet their bees are loving that. You might not want to walk on your bare feet on that.
And now I just learned this the other day, which is kind of crazy for this for. You know, you're taping this program, but Dutch white clover is edible.
It is.
The flowers.
The flowers can be dried and ground into a flower. And the leaves are kind of spinach-esque.
Yeah.
And that was something that Patty and I were going to experiment with and see how that might go.
So back in the day, that's how Dutch white clover kind of got its popularity, is this stuff would grow in more of a drought type situation, and then people could then harvest the flowers and grind them into flour. So pretty amazing.
Wow, that's for real. That's, you know, really interesting.
And talk about a beautiful lawn.
Oh.
You have these large areas, there's a lot of people that we landscape for in this area. In Chicago, it's very different. People have these very small yards, and so they're landscaped, you know. Every square inch is landscaped, and out here it's exactly the opposite. Someone comes and they have a 5-acre lot, and you're like, can you make this look homey? And you're like, 5 acres, that's hard, you know.
Yeah.
But with the largest feature in those areas being lawn or green, you can do these really interesting designs and bring in, you can still have grass. I'm not saying you have to sell your mower, because some people just love to mow grass. You know, you'll see people mowing 10 acres.
It must be,
and you're like,
oh, it might be kind of meditative in a way, because people love to get on that machine and just go, or even walk.
I do. I love mowing grass. I really do, because you don't have to negotiate with grass. It doesn't argue back. It doesn't correct you. It's grass.
Well, you feel
awesome.
So good when you look back, and it looks so lovely. Yeah. When our place is mowed, it really looks like a, you know, it's an estate.
Sure,
absolutely. But when you could bring in these really cool curves and these really interesting designs with the Dutch white clover, and understand, gosh, I don't have to touch that. It's going to choke most of the weedy growth out and a lot of the small
trees. Can you bring
in
some of the taller grasses? I don't know much about grasses. You probably do, Dave, because that's a great landscape.
I should absolutely know more about it. But yes, I mean,
that'll give you some height and some,
I think,
you know,
people,
variety.
I think people, when they think of a native prairie, you know, immediately in their heads go to a Monet print. When in all reality, our prairies are really big blue stem, little blue stem. You know, there's not a lot. It's just more grass than it is anything else. And kind of on the periphery, you get some of this floral, the rutabaccia and coneflowers, things like that. But the native prairies that people want with all the flowers, typically in an ecosystem, you always have competition. You're always going to have one thing that kind of really is stronger and kind of takes over. So that real floral natural prairie that people really desire, it's one of the highest maintenance things that you could
and
possibly
put in. You have to burn, don't you have to burn?
Oh, you've got to burn it, reseed it. You've got to pull out some of the invasive species that are going to kind of take over. Mm-hmm. We manage a few prairies, and it's a daunting task. It's always they're like, well, why isn't it flowering? Or why is it? Well, because it's native. The natives are taking over. Yeah. That's, you know. So I'm like, do you want a native prairie, or do you want a commercially, you know, managed, beautiful flower factory? Because they're two different things.
Yeah, they really are. One of the things I've done is just try to eliminate some of the stuff I'm mowing is I have about a half an acre that I plant to winter rye. Mm-hmm. And that is so beautiful. It's like a blue-green, and it's so pretty. And I don't even let it go to seed. You could let it go to seed, but then my neighbor mows it and rolls it up into bales for me, and I have straw. I grow my own organic straw, and it was kind of hard to find straw around here. So, but it's very pretty, and I think you could use that as a backdrop.
Absolutely,
you know?
Absolutely. There's, we should get in the mindset of maybe just having these things that we can have these large swaths and kind of rethink that. We don't have to be mowing this every single week.
Where are you with landscaping with fruit trees or nut trees?
I love.
Is it just an accent piece, or is it highlight a corner? Or
I think it depends on what fruit trees we're using. Do they need pollinators? Do we have a neighbor? Is there proximity? You know, and things like that. But absolutely, I think again with a young family, people should know where their food comes from. And there's just something about picking an apple off a tree or going out and grabbing. You know, some cherries. Like there's this whole series called Jane Bush cherries. They're just small 5-foot cherry bushes that just get just loaded full of cherries. Now I'm saying this and everyone's going to want one, and we are sold out right now.
No.
They're hard to get. We brought them in and they sold so fast. Come and look again next season. But they're a fun, you know, 5-foot just berry factory.
Oh, that's really nice.
They don't take up a lot of room. They get that beautiful floral, that beautiful aroma in the spring, and then they just start punching out
fruit.
Do you
have to protect them from birds?
Absolutely.
You put a net over them or something?
They have so much fruit that you can share it with the birds.
They couldn't eat it all.
Yeah, but again, absolutely, nuts and fruit trees, they all have a place. Mm-hmm. And you'll see that now they're doing apple trees where they're espalier apple trees, where they look more like a fence.
Right.
And if you go
up into
the orchards by Gay's Mills, you'll start to see that everything is being commercially grown that way. People aren't on ladders. That's much safer.
Oh, gosh.
The yields have been increased. So they're just figuring these things out.
That's a totally different breed of tree, though, right?
Absolutely.
To do that.
Well, no, you can use any kind of tree.
You just have to prune it, right? Uh-huh. But they're not dwarf or semi-dwarf? I mean, they wouldn't be full-size trees that you're espalier.
Well, the dwarf or semi-dwarf, it all depends on the rootstock that you use. That's all it is. They're being grafted onto a dwarf rootstock or a semi-dwarf rootstock.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of commercial apple trees left unless you get into some of the old ones like Wolf River or some of those apples where you get the giant apple tree. Most people and commercial nurseries are growing semi-dwarf. People just don't want anything that's over 15
feet tall.
Oh, gosh.
Well, we made the mistake maybe of buying grocery store apple trees.
Mm.
But we got a Wealthy and a Macintosh. I think the Macintosh has died. But the Wealthy is just beautiful, and it just... I don't know.
How old is it now?
Well, about 45 years old, and it doesn't get any scabs or anything.
It's a great apple tree.
It's a great apple. It's just so beautiful, but I think you couldn't espalier this thing. It's just huge, and, of course, you can't spray them. You can't do anything. They're so huge, and the same with our pear tree, but it's so prolific that it doesn't really matter. But we wait for the pears to drop because you can't even... I don't have an old orchard ladder to get up there to the top. But anyway, they fall down. We catch them on tarps and just harvest them
there
that way.
Yeah.
But I hate to say, we're out of time, guys, really have enjoyed talking with you. Did you have one last?
If I just moved here, don't know anything about the area, and I walk down your driveway at Second Nature at Reed's Creek, what's the one thing you would want me to see there?
Oh, my gosh. I would want you I would want you to see that you're in a space that doesn't feel like you're forced to buy something, but that you're on a walk exploring.
Exactly. And that's what I would that's want. That's what I love about it.
Yeah.
I go often, and I don't always buy there. Well, there's a wonderful pond with a gigantic park. Koi in there. Yeah. And then there's a beautiful greenhouse. Sometimes you have, you know, that first huge greenhouse, you're kind of using that to feature even furniture now or
special
the beautiful
plants,
special plants. But I love the gift shop. Very unusual gifts. And then there's, you know, the evergreens and just wonderful trees.
We specialize in evergreens. So once you get back to where the new building is now, you'll see.
What's the new building for?
Well, the new building is a shop. The guys have been wanting it for a long time, so we finally built a shop. But our
for
design
your machines,
center is.
You mean?
Yep. Uh-huh. Our design center is upstairs now. And then we have a small venue that seats about 50 or 60 people that we are going to be renting out. And then we do a number of events ourselves, educational things. We have field trips that come to the nursery.
Can't all be outdoors sometimes.
Sometimes it can. Sometimes you need one spot to put people in. And we do a number of Christmas, porch pots, wreath building workshops, all that kind of stuff. So now we've got a warm place to do that. And Joseph's having a Trout Unlimited event.
Yeah.
That'll
be great for us because we'll be able to cast fly rods on the lawn. The creek is
creek.
And then
that's
come in
a
and,
really
and sit
spectacular
down
creek for trout fishing.
It is. Yeah.
Well, Joseph Meyer of Latarnia and Dave Tubin of Second Nature Nursery, thank you so much for being on the show. We'll have to do this again because I don't think we covered half of what you were prepared to share.
Sure. Yeah, thanks for having us.
But you gave us a good little taste of what we can do in the edible landscape. Thank you so much for tuning into Who's in the Kitchen. I'm Philothea Beeson. We air at noon every Saturday, and we've been doing so for 15 years, and we're going to keep going. Thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll be back next week.